It's time now for Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle. Now, here's your host, Colin Fluxman.
Hello and welcome again to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle. Each week at this time, we discuss several topics on marriage and divorce and the family in general and financial matters. Our lineup includes Lisa Zonder, famous, well-known divorce attorney, Steve Wagner, equally famous and well-known of Wagner Financial, a financial planner. And we also have input from our famous technical guru. His name is Tom. You know him from the morning. Hi, Lisa, Steve, and Tom.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you.
Good afternoon.
Last week, we introduced the topic of alternatives to marriage, including cohabitation and renewable marriages, as well as how to be smart about managing your finances in the new year. Today, on the legal side, we'll focus on cohab agreements, relationship contracts, staying out of divorce court, and a bunch of other good things. Financially speaking, we'll discuss how to cope with your husband's financial threats during divorce. Do I see your ears prick up? Well, if this applies to you, well, stay tuned. What a volatile stock market may mean for a woman, and how divorcing women should handle retirement accounts and pension. We'll also be talking to the executive director of CASA of Ventura County, CASA standing for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, as well as an advocate. So lots on our plate today and plenty to talk about. Our email address is lisa@divorcetalkradiocalifornia.com. Check us out online at divorcetalkradiocalifornia.com, as well as Facebook and Twitter. Well, last week I asked the question, is marriage headed for an overhaul, a fundamental rethinking? Is it due for one? And I spoke about a column in the New York Times reported back in 2012. Within the last 50 years, cohabitation rates have risen 1,500%. That's 1,500%, with more than 7.5 million unmarried people now living with a partner. Well, is marriage on the out? What is happening? Is marriage going to be something in the future? Are we going to have marriage in the future? Or is it a matter of cohabitation becoming more and more popular? What is it? What is your opinion, Tom?
I think it's in desperate trouble. I think we definitely have a situation here just because of the people I run into and the conversations I hear. Mm-hmm. And it sounds more like let's get out of it rather than let's fix it.
Well, I would have to agree to a certain extent, but I think that marriage will always be around. I
mean, yes.
It is an institution. There's people getting married every day. But, equally so, there are challenges. And I think as we talked a little bit about last week, people are afraid of long-term commitments. So that definitely puts a question mark to it.
Well, I'm wondering what motivates people who are dating to live together. Why cohabit rather than marry?
I think, Colin, a lot of people don't see the need for a piece of paper to confirm that they're actually committed to each other. And that's one of the things that I've heard. And also, sometimes they're thinking about how awful it is to go through a divorce, and they don't want to have the risk of a divorce and worry about, support obligations and dividing or sharing property and the stress and the expense of a divorce. So really, all of those things would come into play, I think, for people who are thinking about alternatives to marriage. And also, you just find people in general are thinking that being single might be appealing because they don't have to worry about losing their freedom, their man caves, their woman caves, whatever it is that they yearn for.
Well, let's discuss research measuring and comparing cohabitation to marriage, shall we? Let's talk about that. What kind of research is being done and has been done?
Well, one of the things that I've been looking at is cohabitation being on the rise, which is something that you just mentioned, and then some of the studies like the RAND study from 2013 that compares and assesses, marriage juxtaposed against cohabitation. I mean, the statistics about cohabitation, let's just talk about that for a second, just to give a, bigger picture here. Almost half of the people who were surveyed said they had lived with someone. And the cohabitation relationships now are actually lasting longer than they were a decade ago. So on average, they're lasting about 22 months, which is, kind of getting close to some marriages in terms of duration, certainly not short-term dating situations.
Well, we spoke last week about the possibility of the introduction of renewable marriages. And that was every 2 years, perhaps. And you mentioned this at 22 months. Which
Correct.
Is pretty close to 2 years. So maybe that may even be an option. Whether it'll ever happen or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, if people are being surveyed, they are thinking that marriage is becoming obsolete, to answer your question from earlier. I saw a study that suggested, I think it was the National Center for Health Statistics, that when polled and asked about marriage becoming obsolete, 4 in 10 Americans said that it is. So that's a pretty staggering statistic right there. About almost 40% of us think that marriage is becoming obsolete. But I wanted to weigh in on that and say one thing, Colin.
Yes.
I think that emotions, human emotions, are pretty much always going to, for the most part, depending on who you are, you know, dictate that people want stability and commitment in relationships. And I do not think that marriage is going away anytime soon. I think people need to work harder and stop making this a disposable generation. I mean, I know cell phones are disposable. I talked about that last show. But I think relationships people need to work harder at.
That is the case. But here's the thing. People want to get married because you mentioned the stability and things like that, but the security, the financial security, mm-hmm. is very important, Steve.
Indeed it is, and I will have to agree with Lisa that, you know, marriage is not out. And whether you're in a marriage or you're not in a marriage, both couples want the same thing. Both individuals want the same thing. They want to have stability, they want to have loyalty, and they really do want this to work out for the long term. Marriage adds a lot of financial incentives to do that. I mean, studies have shown over and over and over again that happily married couples that work together, save together, invest together, end up doing very well in their retirements as opposed to single individuals.
Right.
So, and there are tax advantages, like we talked about last week as well. So, I mean, there's so many positive reasons to make a marriage work. It's definitely worthwhile.
And yet when the marriage dies, then all hell breaks loose, right?
Yes. We remember the movie War of the Roses.
Yes.
You remember that?
Wasn't that
a great movie?
Danny DeVito.
Who
great in so many ways. I don't know. Quite a black comedy, if I've ever seen one.
A black comedy is for sure.
What actually happened there for those who didn't see that movie?
Well, just as a refresher on that, as a happily married couple that knew each other from college, fell in love, got married, had children, and he built a successful law practice. And she stayed home and built a beautiful home, beautiful mansion with beautiful trinkets and furniture and all the other things that go along with it. And then, of course, they fell apart through time. He didn't appreciate her little desire to build a business. And she resented that. And that resentment boiled over to the point where she wanted a divorce. He couldn't accept it. And as a result, they got this divorce. But in the divorce, it really got very, very emotional. And they fought over little trinkets, little things such as that. And that's a very common problem, I might say, with many, many divorce situations today. Allowing emotion to mess up your thinking, so to speak, with regard to what's logical and what's going to work out for your best benefit in the long term.
Well, you know, Steve, wouldn't it be wonderful if couples could divorce without rancor or conflict? Imagine how pleasant it would be if the husband and wife could be completely open and honest and yet remain civil and respectful throughout the divorce proceedings. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
That would be nice.
You'd simply divide, right? Your
Absolutely.
Marital assets, mm-hmm. and then politely part ways, mm-hmm. and say, I love you forever, mm-hmm. we'll see the kids, and that's in an ideal situation.
And in some countries, Colin, there's actually the culture there and the legal system there in other countries is such that when couples break up, that's exactly what happens. There's a kind of a general rule that they'd share custody 50-50 with the children, and they each part ways and go about their business, and the whole divorce, you know, rancor that you mentioned would be avoided. So that's definitely something that in other countries they're attempting to do away with, is all of the attendant divorce issues that come up here, like dividing property and setting support and custody battles.
And I'm looking at the statistics. Cohabitation before marriage has been correlated with a higher likelihood of divorce. In this article that I refer to, the New York Times article, it explains that this phenomenon is likely because couples may decide to live together partially for reasons of convenience or finances, and each partner may have different expectations about future commitment. And when couples talk about their level of commitment and motivations for living together, or are engaged before cohabiting, the likelihood of a successful marriage increases significantly. Mm.
That's pretty funny because I just read a study confirming the opposite. Do
really?
You want to hear this?
Yes, please.
This is hilarious. So I was talking to you about this 2013 RAND study that I found. And here are some of the major points that they make. And one of them is obviously that you'll like this part. Married relationships of any duration consistently ranked higher on all the intensity measures, meaning they're more committed and more intimate than cohabitations. But they also find that the cohabitation, people who cohabited together before marriage tended to have more successful marriages and more intimate marriages. So why are we getting two different studies here? Isn't that interesting? I guess it depends on what study you're looking for to confirm your data points.
You know, when it comes to the matters of a heart, and I'm sure Tom will concur, there's no such a thing as the right and the wrong way.
Yeah, and the one thing about cohabitating is how do your parents feel about that? Mm. Because I know in one situation, cohabitating would not get a visit from the parents. Once married,
yep.
Plenty of visits from the parents. So you deal with a lot of morals from the past where we do look at it now like, hey, not only are we having fun together, we're doing this together, we're sharing together. This makes total sense. And then the next move, the logical move, because I lived with my wife for about a year and a half. And then we got married and we've been married, 14 years? Good enough, right?
Congratulations.
That's great. Thank you very much.
When's the anniversary? Come on.
It's tough. You know why?
You're in trouble now.
I lost my independence on Independence Day, July 4th.
Okay. You picked that on purpose.
So, you betcha.
Easy to remember.
Yeah, that was one of those. But again, I think that is part of the deal. It makes all the sense in the world to me. You should almost by law have to live together first. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think now you should hold up those visual graphics or do something on your iPad when you go to your parents and you're thinking of living with your significant other and take this 2013 RAND study and say, see what it says, that if we live together before marriage, our intimacy is going to be higher if we shacked up beforehand. So therefore, when we go get married, you know, we're going to have a better chance of success. So I think that's what you need to do if you're trying to make an argument to old school parents.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA.
Are you and your spouse contemplating a divorce? Divorce is very stressful and can present a minefield of obstacles. Lisa Zonder is a divorce attorney and mediator. She can help you through this process, providing a number of alternatives to court, such as mediation and collaborative divorce with a professional team. Lisa's main office is on Townsgate Road in Westlake Village. She also serves mediation clients in her satellite office on Camden Drive in Beverly Hills. One call to Lisa will set you on the path to a peaceful and economical resolution that is focused on your family. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zonderfamilylaw.com. Contact Lisa Zonder today, certified family law specialist, State Bar of California, Board of Legal Specialization. Call 805-777-7740 or go online at zonderfamilylaw.com. If you mention you heard it on the radio, your first consultation is free for local and qualified clients. Call 805-777-7740. That's Lisa Zonder, 805-777-7740, or email Lisa at zonderfamilylaw.com. Consultations are granted based on appropriate qualification as determined by Lisa Zonder. Her practice is limited to family law matters in Ventura County and Beverly Hills. Going through a divorce is never easy. It's not only emotionally draining, but the many financial decisions can add to your stress. For over 25 years, Ventura-based Stephen Wagner, certified financial planner of Wagner Financial, has been helping people just like you make smart decisions when emotions can sometimes get in the way. From planning your retirement income to investment management, Steve Wagner can create a roadmap that you can understand and follow as you embark on your new life. In addition to providing clients with access to informative financial content and useful tools, Wagner Financial will make you feel more confident about your financial stance now and in the future. Call 805-339-0760 for an appointment. That's 805-339-0760 or log on to wagnerfinancial.com. For that one-on-one personalized financial attention, call Steve Wagner Financial on 805-339-0760. 805-339-0760. Stephen H. Wagner is an investment advisor representative with Transamerica Financial Advisors, as well as securities and investment advisory services offered through TFA, member FINRA, SIPC, and a registered investment advisor. Wagner Financial is not affiliated with TFA.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA. Well, as we mentioned about divorcing couples sitting down together respectfully in an ideal situation, Steve, what advice do you have to help women cope with their husband's financial threats when it does come down to divorce?
Well, absolutely. The most important thing would be to have an attorney of your own hired. Obviously, that's where Lisa comes in, because husbands will bully. I mean, that's just kind of man's nature from time to time. But what they'll do very often is they'll try to pawn off assets when they split things that have gone up in value a lot. She'll get those so that if she sells them, she'll have to pay higher taxes than what he would have to pay. So there are, that's just one of the dirty tricks. And you know, we'll talk about more dirty tricks in shows ahead. But that is one of the common tricks that a husband will try to play on his wife. So very important that very early on in the process that both sides have quality representation.
Yes. So as the divorce proceedings unfold, a woman may even find herself in the uncomfortable position of having to endure threats about the finances from the husband. Angry husbands can be prone to irrational outbursts. And over the years, it seems as though clients have heard it all from,
yes,
I'd rather give everything to my lawyer than to see you get one dime. I'll go to jail before I give you everything.
And sadly, I've actually heard that from clients.
Yes.
So, and it's just so negative. And again, it gets right back to the whole mediation process, where if somehow, some way early on, you can get logic overruling emotions and hire someone like Lisa, you're going to have a lot of success and a lot more money at the end of the day.
Let me just also add, though, that sometimes we have female clients who are the breadwinners, and I've had female physicians and such, so I'm trying to bring some gender equality here. It's not just the men who play dirty.
Okay, that's cool.
Well,
so
thank
I just want to equalize the field, and
thank you
for talking about this as a general stereotypical male problem, but I think women do it too. It's whoever's the person, you know, whoever is likely to have to pay support or give away some property that they perceive as their retirement and not a joint retirement or community property, that's the person who's going to have the emotional reaction, and it's not always men.
Could I interject something on that as well?
Yeah.
You know, obviously we talked about the War of the Roses, and they fought over things, and it was all emotional. I had a real life story. It wasn't so much a War of the Roses, but it gets to the central issue of dividing property and not letting emotion rule the day. This was back in 2007, and we all know what was happening to housing prices back in 2007. They were beginning to fall. Well, this couple got a divorce. The wife just was in love with her home. And of course, he wanted his half. So what did she do? She went out and took a loan against the house, paid him a check for like $300,000. He walked away with $300,000. She was left with the house. And of course, 3 short years later, she lost the house.
Wow.
So, I mean, it really gets to don't let emotion rule the day here when you're dividing assets in a situation.
Ultimately, who are the winners and who are the losers?
The winners are the people that act logically and that have hired good representation and that have the long-term picture in mind. That's
yes.
Those are the winners.
Right. Yeah. I think the lawyers are the winners, with all due respect. And the losers, unfortunately, are the kids.
Well,
the kids get caught in the middle, and it's just the most unfortunate thing I've seen personally, and I'm sure we've all been through the married state. Where friends have,
I've seen pathetic examples in my life where the kid was used as I get him now. The guy would get him, my friend would get the kid, and he'd throw him in a room, and the kid would watch TV.
Awful.
And I'm thinking, and that's you getting your kid?
Yeah. Right.
He went to a Grateful Dead concert instead of his kid's Little League tryout.
Well.
And that was the thing. I wanted to go over to her and say, hey, if you need somebody to voice for you, if you will, show you support, this was terrible. But he said, I get the kid, so I want the kid, and he's going to be here.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen the opposite, where the wife will wrongfully accuse the husband of some kind of sexual abuse, child abuse.
Right.
And I've got one of my best friends was accused of that.
Just to get back at him, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Never was able to see his daughter again, ever.
Well, you know, speaking about kids being losers, this is why I introduced this. Today, more than 420,000 children in the U.S. foster care system struggle with issues including sibling separation, permanency, education, and reunification. Ventura County CASA, court-appointed special advocate, has existed since 1985, when a group of concerned judges, attorneys, and community members felt that objective, caring support for these children during court proceedings and out-of-home placement was necessary. The CASA advocate, as an officer of the court, is the eyes and ears of the court, reporting to the judge and attorneys the child's progress and needs. CASA needs volunteers, and if you've just gone through a divorce and are looking to make a difference in your community and doing something worthwhile if you feel that your life is just over, this may just be the opportunity. On the line now is Miriam Mack, Executive Director of CASA Ventura, and an advocate, Sharman Bush. Miriam and Sharman, thanks for holding. I know you've been online for a while, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Miriam, please tell us about your organization and specifically what is involved in becoming an advocate.
Well, you did a very good introduction, and we have community volunteers from all walks of life. We recruit, we try to get the word out about our organization. They go through a very extensive background check, fingerprinting, Department of Justice, Child Abuse Index. We have interviews with them. We get personal reference checking with them because, of course, these volunteers are going to be working with children. Once they're screened and we talk with them about their circumstances and get a sense of that they'll be a good fit, we have a 30-hour training that is conducted over about a month's time, and this is very, very good training that is directed by national and our state organizations. Once they complete the training and they become child abuse mandated reporters, they are sworn in by the court. It is a very impressive ceremony. It's a very serious ceremony. And once they're sworn in, then they start coming into the office, and we try to pair them with a child from our waiting list that we think will be a good match and will benefit.
Sharman, you've been a CASA advocate since 2009, I understand, 4 years now. And you have a lot of experience about what the children are going through and the role of the CASA. What motivated you to volunteer?
Well, gosh, I have worked with kids for so long and have just seen a lot of children go through tough circumstances. So I wanted to be a help, and I figured after looking into a lot of organizations, I just came to believe CASA was one of the finest around. Went through the training, and I have just loved it. I'm on my third child now. The first two were adopted, and it's been an amazing, amazing experience.
Well, I understand volunteers come from all walks of life. Obviously, they do. Men and women, too. But they have many things in common. What are some of them? They care about at-risk children, for example.
Definitely. I think a lot of them now find themselves with time. And you mentioned men. We really need more men advocates because our male advocates can only be paired with a boy or
yes.
a young boy, and we don't have enough male advocates. So list end up with a female advocate, which is good, but it's perhaps not as good as if they had another male working with them.
Do they, in a sense, become foster parents or a foster mother or father?
No, not in that sense, because they don't come to our homes. But we, unfortunately, many times become the most consistent person in this child's life. I think of my first child I had. When she was five, she was in four different kindergartens, four different foster homes, had different social workers. And even though when I heard in the training that I might be the most consistent person, I thought, that can't be. But I found out it was.
Mm-hmm.
Followed her all along from home to home, to school to school, and tracked with her, and it's amazing to be able to do that, to interface with teachers and with the lawyers and social workers. And what's great about this is we only have one job: what is in the best interest of the child.
Of course, always. But how does the CASA relate to the child that he or she represents?
Yeah, I'm going to let Sharm answer that, but I do want to make the point that it is a one-to-one relationship, and unlike other organizations, the advocate does not introduce the child to their family, doesn't take them into their home, and has to really adhere to very, very strict confidentiality about revealing information about the child. It's a very, very special one-on-one relationship.
So let me understand where the CASA gets the authority. Where do they get their authority?
For the court. They are sworn officers of the court, and then that gives them access to social worker files, doctor information, education, teacher information. They really are an independent eyes and ears.
And the difference between the CASA and the social service caseworker?
Well, for one, it's volunteer, and I think the most important difference, unfortunately, social workers are so busy and have so many cases, and CASAs have one, maybe two children, so we get to really focus on building a connection with a child that's going to many, many times make a difference throughout their entire life.
Let's look at Ventura County right now, and tell me, how many children are in foster care in this county?
There are about 1,000 children in who are dependents of the court, who are in foster care, and about every year, 500 children or so, almost 500 children, are removed from their homes right here in Ventura County.
And how many CASAs are currently active in Ventura County?
We have about 140 advocates, and on an annual basis, we touch about a little more than 200 children. So that's only 20% of the population, and that's why it's so important that we encourage people to think about volunteering for our organization, because there is a very huge need that we would like to be able to fulfill.
Sharman, you must have had plenty of upsides in your position as an advocate and downsides as well. What is the worst and the best of what you do?
Oh, the best, gosh, there's so many of those. One thing I remember is taking a young girl, my first girl, she was 5. She had never been to the beach, even though she lived in Ventura, and we walked over the sand. She stopped and looked at the water and said, "Oh, this is like heaven." And then we went down, and we just jumped up and down in the waves, and her laughter, oh my, I've never forgotten it. And that was 3 years ago now, and I just talked with her that probably last month, and she said, "I still have dreams about going to that beach." So that's just one that comes to my mind.
And anything that is a bad experience, and have you been in a situation where you've been with a child and it just hasn't worked out and there's nothing you can do?
Oh, gosh. Sometimes the situations are heart-rending, and I was in a situation where there was a young boy, and he was in a group home, and it was just the wrong placement for him. He was not getting the speech services he needed, the occupational therapy, and that was really hard just to navigate and watch this young boy who had so much potential not getting what he needed. But fortunately, the one thing, sometimes this can sound really overwhelming. It's like, oh, my gosh, I can't do that. But CASA has amazing supervisors and staff, so 24/7 we can call someone and say, "What do I do? I'm not sure what to say or what to do." And so there's so much support. So if anybody is thinking about becoming a CASA and just saying, "I couldn't do it," you could, because there's so much help. The staff at CASA has been amazing, and I feel like I could call them anytime I need to.
Is there an age requisite for an advocate?
21 is the minimum.
And the oldest range?
No, there's no age. There is an age limit.
Okay.
We ask about, you know, if our advocates, you know, you have to drive, and because taking the child out, as Charm said, is kind of important, and just spending some time with them. We ask our advocates to spend about 15 hours a month or so, and that's kind of like once a week. So there is driving, and as Sharm said, also the children move. So, you know, you may be paired with someone in CME and live in CME, and the child may have to be placed in another community.
I'm sure we have many listeners who would love to participate in this fantastic organization. How does someone interested in volunteering apply?
Oh, well, that's great. We have an informational session that's coming up January 30th in the evening in Camarillo. And if you call our office at 389-3120, we can give you information about where it is going to be, where it's going to take place. And I think that's probably the best way. People can also go onto our website at CASAofVenturaCounty.com. www.divorcelisasunderstyle.org to contact us, but we would love, we have a training coming up in February, so the informational session is really, really important. It'll give you a really honest look at what you're getting into and the real value of spending your time in this way.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful response. And those numbers again, 805-389-3120. And the website is casaofventuracounty.org. Is that right?
That is right.
Do you also have the CASA advocates going into the courtroom with the children?
Oh, yeah, good question. The children have hearings about every 6 months. And we are, one of the main responsibilities of the CASA is to prepare an independent report for the judge. So, and to be at that hearing. So our advocates do go to court about every 6 months with the child. Sometimes the child's not there for the child. And the judge really looks at the CASA's report in addition to looking, obviously, at the social worker's report and other information. But court reports are a very important responsibility. And, again, we have our supervisors to help make sure the correct information is moving forward.
What kinds of information do the CASA advocates collect and report to the judges?
Charm can add, but they let the judge know how the child is doing emotionally, how the placement is going, how the child, how they feel the child is doing in school, and just independent observations about is the child happy or sad or gone AWOL, or sometimes they may comment on the medications or special needs that they think the child would benefit from.
What's great is that the judge really does listen. So we typically have hearings every 6 months, but one case I had, things were just not moving, the things the judge had asked to be done. So I requested an interim hearing for a month, and the judge said, granted. And some other people didn't like that, but sometimes you get to push and push so that the wheels turn a little quicker. So, and then it's so interesting. We go on Mondays. It's always on Mondays, and it's serious. There's the social worker. There's the attorneys of the parents and of everyone. And then Fridays are adoption days at the juvenile court. And, oh, my gosh, it's a different place. You walk in, and after you get everything, so there's balloons and there's cameras. The judge comes down from where you normally sit, and he has a row of teddy bears. So the adoptive child afterward
must be an amazing sight and scene and experience.
It's just so wonderful.
Now, Sharman, you went through the training, 30 hours of training. What does it involve, actually? Can you go through step by step what the training is?
When I did it, it was 40, and it was once a week, and now they're moving it to a Tuesday and a Saturday, doing it in a little compressed schedule. But it's a wonderful combination. It's things about, obviously, things you have to look at as far as law and child abuse reporting, but a lot of it has to do with relationships and what your specific, quote-unquote, job is.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but does the advocate go through some kind of psychological testing to make sure that he or she is psychologically well fitted to render this job adequately?
Well, I think that's what our interview process is. We have our staff and experienced volunteers, such as Charm, would be interviewing the person. We get their criminal reports, their fingerprintings. It's not a psychological evaluation, but it's a pretty in-depth analysis, and there are occasions, most people are absolutely wonderful. There are occasions when there just isn't the fit. But the training is very, very comprehensive. As Charm said, it's about the law. It's about the role of the CASA. It's about a little bit about child development, family dynamics. We have one day there's a panel of experienced volunteers really tell the trainees what it's like, what they're going to experience, what could happen, and really give them some insights. Have a panel discussion with we get one time with the judges and the attorneys come and try to help the trainees understand the roles of the various players in the process. So we cover the gamut.
So how does the advocate gather information about a case?
Well, we contact a lot of people. We stay in touch with the child social worker. We also, when we pick the child up, we are going to the foster home, so we get to know the foster family. And usually we can get to know them pretty well, sometimes not. We also, if the child's in school, can talk to their teachers, since we're approved by the court to do that. No one had his educational rights, so I held those and was pretty involved in what was going on with school with him, just for a short period.
Well, your organization is doing a wonderful job. I just want to repeat the number again, 805-389-3120. And the website, CasaOfVenturaCounty.org. Miriam and Sharma, thank you so much. Sharman, thank you so much for being part of our discussion today.
Thank you.
And thank you for having us.
Yes. Thank you very much. And good luck.
Thank you.
Have you already filed for divorce and are overwhelmed by the process? Or you're in the midst of a divorce and not sure what to do next? Well, we have the answer for you. The Second Saturday Divorce Workshop. Explore the legal, financial, and emotional aspects of divorce. Discover community resources available to help you. Talk with others experiencing similar life changes. Learn from the experts who have guided others through divorce. Divorce educational and informational workshops are held at Ventura College of Law, 4475 Market Street in Ventura, on the second Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Register by calling 805-372-1810. That's 805-372-1810. Or email us at secondsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. That's 2ndsaturdaywestlake@gmail.com. Call 805-372-1810. 805-372-1810. Please do not phone the law school. Registration is through our Second Saturday website. We look forward to answering your questions.
You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on the air each week at this time, Saturdays 3 to 4 p.m. on AM 1590 KVTA. I'm Colin Flaxman. With me in the studio is Lisa, Steve, and Tom. And we've been discussing cohabitation versus marriage. And Lisa, there are obviously certain legalities relative to cohab agreements and arrangements, right?
Right.
What are some of them?
Well, you know, if you live together with a partner and don't have a cohabitation agreement, you might have claims against you, like in the Marvin Palamoni case that we talked about on our last show.
Yes.
And so you have some exposure and vulnerability legally to claims to share your property, to pay support potentially, but those claims sound in contract law. Not family law, you know, rights that are granted based on the family code for married couples. So there's a big distinction there.
Right. You mentioned Lee Marvin, but the Clint Eastwood case stands out in my mind. In 1989, Sondra Locke, Clint Eastwood's cohab partner for 14 years, filed a palimony suit against Eastwood after he changed the locks on their Bel Air home and placed her possessions in storage while she was directing the film Impulse. You may remember that. The two parties reached a settlement in 1990 when Eastwood set up a film development directing pact for Locke at Warner Brothers in exchange for dropping the suit.
Interesting. And I think the terms of their settlement were private, if I'm not mistaken, so nobody actually knows what the details are.
But is that why they called him Dirty Harry?
He was Dirty Harry long before that. But in 1995, Locke sued Eastwood for fraud, alleging that he had compensated Warner Brothers to keep her out of work, interestingly enough. The studio had rejected all of the 30 or more projects she proposed and never assigned her to direct any of their in-house projects. According to Locke's attorney, Eastwood committed the ultimate betrayal by arranging the bogus film directing deal in 1996. Just minutes before a jury was to render a verdict in Locke's favor, Eastwood agreed to settle for an undisclosed amount. Now, these are well-publicized cases, and I'm sure, Lisa, in your experience, you've come across less well-publicized cases, and it's quite a hair-raising situation when it comes to this kind of situation, isn't it?
It is. I think a lot of people just assume that if they live together, you know, they'll just break up and there won't be any kind of legal rights or liabilities, and that's a mistake. Sometimes people also think mistakenly that they have a common law marriage because they live together for a long time. And that's not true either. So there is no such thing. It's abolished long ago in California. as common law marriages in California, just so people are really clear about that. So you can't say you're my common law spouse because I called you my husband or you called me your wife.
But in the event of a breakup, does the court take into account the number of years that they've spent together when looking at any kind of financial arrangement or settlement?
That would be true in divorce, but when it comes to common law, remember this is a contract.
It's based. A contract. It's a
so really civil the question contract, is right? It's a civil contract. So really the question is what were the terms of the contract? Mm-hmm. See, this is very different from divorce law where, you know, the courts are looking for spousal support or alimony and they look to the duration of the relationship. How long were they together? That's not the case in common law. I mean, cohabitation. It's actually different because it sounds in contract. It depends. Did your partner say he was going to support you for the rest of your life? I mean,
right.
So now you're proving up a contract.
So with cohabitation partners, it's a matter of caveat emptor.
Mm-hmm. Buyer beware.
Let the buyer beware, right? So you've got to know what you're getting into, right?
Absolutely.
So So generally speaking, you live together and break up, the legal rights to support, those disappear unless there is some kind of contract.
Unfortunately, that's the case. So if and when your relationship breaks up and you've been living together, you don't have any right by statute like you would in a divorce. You don't have a right to support payments. Again, contrast that with spousal support or alimony rights in a family law case.
Mm-hmm. I have a quick question, if I can break.
No, you can't. Who said you can't?
I apologize. I'm going to get Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry, right.
What if they would have had children? How would that have changed
the situation? I think that's our caller from our last show had asked that very same question, because you have boyfriend and girlfriend living together. They have children. Does that mean that because they're not married, somehow there's no right to child support or custody? No, absolutely not. There's still a whole body of law called the Uniform Parentage Act that's we call commonly paternity. And once paternity is established and the court makes a legal order that someone is the dad, then what happens is the court can then set custody and support right after. So instantly you can have child custody arrangements settled and determined. You can have the support issue determined as well. Not spousal support, but child support.
Now, paternity testing, the DNA testing, it's not 100%. You cannot show 100% that the father is the father and the mother is the mother. It's the probability, the likelihood. There's a 90% likelihood. So that's not ironclad, obviously.
Right.
Are there preventative measures that you can take if you're going to live with a partner?
Yeah, there are definitely some things you can do. If, you know, you could get an agreement, that would be the best. Obviously, I mean, everybody should try and secure an agreement. Unfortunately, it's not always possible to secure an agreement because it takes the consent of your partner. So what would you do then in that case if you don't have consent? Well, the next best thing to do is to make sure your name is on title. If you're going to purchase an asset together, you know, a lot of people, they'll say, okay, we'll buy a house together and the male partner puts his name on it and, you know, female partner is left out. And she says, well, I thought I actually had this case. I've had cases like it where she says, I thought you intended to make this our joint purchase. Well, if you're not on the deed and you can't prove that you had, under that Marvin case we talked about, a contract, you may be out of luck. So if you and your partner are in agreement that an asset belongs to you, it should be in both of your names. You should know what the different forms of title are. There's joint tenancy, tenants in common, et cetera. Even if you have credit problems, there are ways to make sure your name is on title. So that's one thing. So get your name on title. The second thing I would say is also make sure that you stay financially independent, because you don't know if you have no agreement, if you're ever going to be able to make a claim under that Marvin case. You don't want to be so financially dependent on your partner that you have no way of taking care of yourself afterwards. And the courts, even when you make that Marvin claim, don't award temporary spousal support or the equivalent of that in a Marvin case. So, if you don't have something in writing, you may not have anything enforceable and you may have no recourse. The other thing I would say, item number three, would be document understandings that you have. So, for example, if you're the male partner and you're pretty clear that you're not getting married to this woman who you're with, and you instead, want to keep everything separate and you want your property, your house, for example, to be in your name alone. Make sure you have some clear documentation, even if it's not a written agreement that both parties sign. Send it to an attorney or do whatever you need to do, but have something that says, you know, I'm keeping her name off deliberately. I'm not making any promises. You know, when you're out at the barbecue that you do together or a party, make sure that you don't say, oh, I'm giving everything over to my, partner. If we break up, it's half mine. You know, make it really clear what your intentions are.
What happens when one of the partner dies? Then what are the rights of the other one without, for example, leaving that person in his or her will?
Yeah, generally you wouldn't have any unless you made those kinds of estate plans, and that's exactly right. I mean, you would be out of luck as well living together without anything in writing.
And this is where communication comes in so much. You know, obviously my job as a financial advisor, we deal with these situations every day, and I would only say, in adding to what Lisa talked about, having an agreement, even in the absence of an ironclad agreement, to kind of come to your point, Colin, about if one of the spouse or one of the partners dies, were there beneficiary arrangements in place? Because those are ironclad in court. So it gets down to communication, having an idea of who's going to get what if something were to happen, even in the absence of a marriage contract.
Right. Let's get to some financial questions here, back into the marriage realm, as it were, how divorcing women should handle retirement accounts and pension plans. And we're not isolating men from the equation, but in particular, how women should handle retirement accounts and these pension plans.
Well, in almost every situation, if there is a pension plan or a 401k plan, there must be what's called a qualified domestic relations order.
Quadro, yes.
Or quadro, mm-hmm. for short. This has to be done and should be done before the divorce settlement is finalized. There are tragic consequences if it's not done. For example, if, let's say, again, here we have the woman as the beneficiary of this quadro. The divorce is final, but the quadro hasn't been finalized, and the husband employee dies, and that pension plans and that quadro was not in place, she would end up potentially getting nothing from that quadro settlement. So it's extremely important that it's finalized before the divorce is finalized.
We actually had Louise Nixon, if you recall, on that topic of quadros and why it's so important to get the qualified domestic relations orders entered. They need to also be sent to the plan for approval. Mm-hmm. They need to be filed with the courts and served on the plan once they're approved.
Now, this can be done with people cohabiting, right? They don't necessarily have to be married. Is that right? Is this the case?
No, I don't think so.
I'm looking at shaking heads here.
No, see, generally speaking, Colin, what you're talking about is a marital right, so that has to do with community property rights that obtain, so normally this wouldn't even apply in a cohabiting situation.
Yes, but if you have someone who has retirement and pension plans, they can draw up a separate agreement about if he dies, then she'll be entitled to...
Mm-hmm. That's an estate planning issue. That would be something you would take
care of. Well, excuse me, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know this.
Okay.
I would like to add one thing, though, Colin. About the whole quadro issue. And it's not discussed a lot, and it falls through the cracks, and it has to do with, again, we got the man that probably managed all the money and made all the investment decisions in the 401k, and now she's going to get her half. She needs to be educated as to how to invest that money.
Right, but Lisa will disagree because she'll say that a lot of women are handling this themselves.
I thought I qualified this.
And it's the man who should worry about handling the retirement account because she's done
indeed.
That.
Are we talking about your objectives or are we talking about averages?
Not at all. I don't fit into this equation at all.
But the funny thing is, hearing this conversation, I mean, I've been shocked by a few things that I just always thought were facts, and the conversation that just I'm thinking, oh my. So this should almost be a high school course. I don't even mean, because you know what you know
agreed.
What you don't know, but there's everything you just, how
yes,
would somebody
why bother
know this
with
before
math and history
but,
and
no,
English
because
and Latin?
Because your math will be history.
That's right. That's right. I'm with Tommy on this one. I appreciate this very, very much. There's not enough financial education as we go through school, and this would be a big help, a big benefit, particularly, and I'm sorry to say this, for the young ladies out there, because they're the ones that end up
I am rolling my eyes for
the record. But we know that's clicking little
and
by little.
And beautiful eyes they are.
Thank you.
But again, just to go very quickly on this, this just astounds me. So I wouldn't, all the things I assume, then, oh, that's how it goes. But all your garbage is done. So how would somebody possibly know this going into a relationship? So
well, you know, the kids are taught how to write a check at school. They teach them how to write checks and things like that. But nothing like this is discussed.
But that's true. And I think teaching it in high school is a little premature unless most people are getting married at high school level. What I would say is if you're a couple thinking of getting married, some people will go into religious counseling. Mm-hmm. Other people will go and consider drawing up a cohabitation agreement, something in writing. And that's where you will get more information about your legal rights and obligations. And so then you can make some decisions. And each partner should have a separate attorney when they do these cohabitation agreements so they're aware. So
yikes.
That would
yikes. Yikes. And then there's the credit card training for women in high school. We like that.
Credit card training for women?
That's all
women?
For the chauvinism. I'm all done with it. Sorry.
He has to get it out of his system today.
Let's not go there. You're listening to Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle on AM 1590 KVTA.
Need a lawyer? The Ventura County Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service is a state bar certified referral service dedicated to finding you the right lawyer. The County Bar Association is a non-profit corporation providing this referral program as a public service, which meets the American Bar Association standards. If you need legal help, the LRIS can place you in touch with a qualified lawyer who will assist you with your problem for a reasonable fee of $35 for a 30-minute consultation. Call the experienced professional staff at the County Bar Association at 805-650-7599, 805-650-7599, or email bar@vcba.org. The right call for the right lawyer. The Lawyer Referral and Information Service. 805-650-7599.
AM 1590 KVTA, Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle with Colin, Lisa, Steve, and Tom. We have about 5 minutes left for the show. Unfortunately, I'm having such a good time here. Can we briefly talk about the stock market?
Sure,
Steve,
absolutely.
And what it may mean for a woman's divorce settlement agreement.
Well, I'm already in a tremendous amount of hot water as I talk about
be careful.
Women.
Tread lightly.
I will tread very, very lightly. I will say, though, my best clients are women. And I think, you know, because we've gone
through... I wonder why.
Well, here's the reason
You're
why.
Such a good-looking guy.
Well, aside from all of that. But, I mean, no, I'm actually not, but that's okay. That's why I'm on radio.
Okay. good face for radio.
Thank you. All right. But our best clients are women, and mm-hmm. I think it's because of the decades-long progression of divorce and then them having to be on their own. I think they've grown accustomed to becoming more independent, and by their very nature... and this is a pedestal for women, I might add, that women are more detail-oriented. So they ask me more questions. They're not afraid to ask, quote-unquote, dumb questions. And so they've really empowered themselves. And I've got to be honest with you. They are phenomenal clients to have because they really want to educate themselves. And that's what I would be saying to women today with regard to the volatile stock market. Make sure you have a relationship with a good financial advisor. As you come out of your divorce, actually, as you go into your divorce, and really get to know him or her and build a relationship and educate yourself. Because once you have that knowledge, as we've all heard, knowledge is power, and that can really, really help you through the ups and downs of the market.
No such a thing as a stupid question, just a stupid answer, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So we're going to be talking about mediation and other aspects of divorce in our show next week. But briefly, Lisa, if we could go back to the Marvin action that you spoke about in cohabitation, are there ways to defend against a Marvin action?
Yeah, some of the defenses to a Marvin action include that the statute of limitations has run on it, so you have to move promptly in order to assert your claims or you may lose them. So that's one thing, a statute of limitations. There is even a case that suggested that it runs when the relationship ends, but if the spouse, the defendant, I would say, continues to perform after the breakup, that the statute of limitations doesn't stop or doesn't begin running until the defendant stops performing. And that was the Cochran case that was kind of famous that you may have heard about. Also, there are some other things that you could use to defend against a Marvin claim, and I'm going to use this dirty word with you again, meretricious, because you keep looking at me funny when I use
no,
it.
No, I think it's a wonderful
the Marvin
word.
Case
it's a wonderful word.
Recites that if there's a contract between unmarried persons, it won't be valid if sexual acts are an inseparable part of the consideration for the agreement. Do I need to spell that out again? So
you
meretricious.
Need to, yeah.
What
yeah.
that means essentially is that if you're paying for your sex with your partner and that's the primary reason that you're
right.
in the relationship, that's not a
it
good enough.
Count.
Right. That's not
it,
that's not good
it
enough
has
to sustain.
No merit, in other words, right?
So there are cases, for example, where someone's paying a companion and a hostess, like in Pretty Woman. You remember that movie?
Yes.
No, well before my time.
Before your time. Okay, Colin. Sure.
Wonderful movie.
It
of
was
course.
A great movie.
Yeah, great movie. Yeah.
And so there are a lot of other defenses to Marvin actions. A lot of them are kind of, legal concepts. But if the contract was promotive of divorce, if the agreement was too vague, if it was there was a lack of mutuality, the choice of law, if they made the Marvin contract in another state, then that might govern whether that contract is enforceable or not in your particular state. So all of those things, equitable defenses also apply. So, if someone has unclean hands and were involved in it, that could be another defense to a Marvin case.
That's it for this show this week. Thanks so much again, Lisa, Steve, and Tom. And we look forward to being with you again next Saturday at the same time. I'm Colin Fluxman.
Tune in every Saturday at 3 p.m. for Divorce Lisa Zonderstyle.
This radio programming is not intended to encourage anyone to seek a divorce. The producers assume that callers are seeking basic information. The radio program is intended to be an informational format and does not constitute legal advice. Anyone with legal, mental health, financial, or other professional questions is directed to retain a competent professional after carefully interviewing qualified professionals. A guest appearance by a particular panelist does not constitute a specific recommendation by the producers as to the expertise of that professional, nor does that panelist's views necessarily reflect the views of the producer.